This is Conor Lennon from UN News. The head of the UN's labour agency warns that a recovery in the international labour market is still a long way off, with a lot of uncertainty for workers and businesses hoping for the economy to bounce back. Guy Ryder, the Director General of the International Labour Organization, or ILO, spoke to me at the launch of the agency's World Employment and Social Outlook Trends 2022 report, which offers gloomy projections of increased unemployment and widening inequality between developed and developing countries. I started by asking Mr. Ryder why the estimate is so dramatically different from the previous report released in June of last year.
What our report published today shows is a serious downward revision of our projections for labour markets in the coming year, and indeed into 2023. I'll just give you the one figure which I think summarises this rather negative story best. Throughout the pandemic, we've sort of calculated the health of labour markets in terms of the number of hours which are actually worked by people around the world. And our projection for 2022, just beginning, is that we are still 52 million full-time job equivalents below pre-pandemic levels. That is really a very considerable deficit in jobs. And that compares, as you've indicated, to a deficit of just 26 million that we projected last June. So, you know, it's doubled. Why is this? Well, this downward revision has mostly to do with the continuing impact of the pandemic, particularly, you know, the appearance of the Omicron variant and everything that that has brought. So this is not good news. It shows that our recovery process is incomplete, clearly incomplete. It's uncertain because there are many downside risks appearing, and it's very unequal. This is an important point. Some countries are doing relatively well, others not so well. And that has, I think, important implications for issues of inequality and global recovery properly meant.
What the report shows is that the recovery projections are strongest in the high-income countries and lower-middle-income economies are faring worst. Why do you think that is? What are the main reasons?
I think there are two basic reasons. It's of course, a complex story, but two very clear reasons. The first one, as you would expect, I think, is the unequal rollout of vaccination programs. The richer countries, for reasons we're all aware of, are doing pretty well, some doing very well in getting their people vaccinated. And this is a sort of a precondition for opening up economic activity in something like normal conditions. The developing world, unfortunately, is not in that same favorable position. And added to that, and these two effects are cumulative, is the fact the richer economies, almost by definition, have been able to invest very substantial resources in stimulating their economy, protecting workers, promoting enterprises, getting demand into their economies. Of course, the developing world hasn't been able to do that. So if you put those two effects together, what you get is what the Secretary General has referred to as this great divergence along the recovery trajectory. And it should worry us, it should worry us, because we were already concerned about inequalities going into the pandemic. That has been made worse during the pandemic. And if we can talk about exiting the pandemic right now, well, I'm afraid these diverging trajectories run the risk of us getting into an even worse situation. And this is very serious.
Now, you mentioned some of the ways, the fact that higher income countries, they basically, as you say, they have the financial muscle, and we've seen a lot of experimentation, things like furloughing workers, low interest loans, forgiven loans, various means to keep businesses afloat so they can keep employing people. If you are a government in a country that doesn't have that kind of financial muscle, what are the sort of recommendations that you're putting in the report to help keep businesses going and keep workers in jobs?
Yeah, I think the starting point is to say that governments around the world have made very considerable, I think, unprecedented efforts in the face of the pandemic to keep economic and social life going, to, you know, try to reconcile these apparently conflicting health and economic objectives in ways which we're all familiar with and which continue to be an object of public debate. Now, United States, European countries, China, they've done pretty well. They've had the resources. They've been willing to spend on a very wide basis to keep their economies going. So what can the developing countries do? What can the emerging economies do? Well, there are limits to what they can do is the answer to that. Many have, I think, done, I think to the extent of their possibilities, a lot to protect people and to promote enterprises. But frankly, they're running out of fiscal road, and there's only one way forward from that, and that lies in the international arena. We do need to pump in more liquidity, more resources to the developing and emerging economies. And we're seeing some efforts in that regard. Firstly, you've had the sort of the, I would say, the passive side of things, that is to try to help on debt relief, debt alleviation, debt service payment relief. But we need more than that. And the IMF has responded with this allocation, unprecedented, of course, of $650 billion in special drawing rights. We still face the tasks, don't we, of transferring that liquidity from the countries which initially receive the special drawing rights to the countries that need them, and then putting them to work for the purposes which they are eventually intended. I think one very important thing that's come out of the United Nations has been the launching by the Secretary General in September of the Global Accelerator for Jobs and Social Protection, which I think offers us a very important vehicle to make this type of international support a reality.
Temporary work is mentioned in the report. You talk about the role of temporary work as being an important one during all kind of crises. I mean, could you explain why it forms a buffer during crises, and is anything different this time?
Two starting points on this one. The first is to say, historically, if you look at most labour market crises or economic recessions, what tends to happen is temporary workers lose their jobs most quickly. It's easy to do it. You just don't renew a contract of an existing temporary worker. So they get sort of pushed out of the labour market early on. And that's what's happened during this this crisis as well. But now, today, we see the level of temporary work at the initial pandemic level. So what's interesting here is not that there's been a change in the overall level of temporary work. In fact, it's been quite stable when looked at on the whole. But there are new temporary jobs which have replaced the old temporary jobs. There's been quite a significant churn in temporary work. The pre-pandemic trend is for quite long-term increases in temporary work as a proportion of the whole. We'll have to see as we exit the pandemic whether the temporary work continues to occupy this increasing part of overall labour markets. And there are plus and there are minus sides to temporary work. It can be a way of getting people back into work. It can be a way of getting labour markets moving again. And hopefully it's a way of acting as a stepping stone for people entering the labour market to graduate to more permanent and more secure jobs. In the developing world, it tends to be a different story, I have to say. Temporary work is often synonymous to casual work, to informal employment, doesn't tend to lead anywhere except to the next temporary job. And clearly, that's not the type of labour market evolution that is most beneficial.
How long do you think this is all going to last? I mean, you had your predictions last year. You clearly felt that, I mean, I remember you saying that things were very bad back then, but you could perhaps see a brighter future. This is not what a brighter future looks like. So where is the way out?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question which I hesitate to address in very specific terms, given the difference between the projections we made 6 months ago and what we're saying now. What I can say is the report we're publishing now shows that even by the end of 2023, so more or less 2 years from now, we don't expect the world, taken in the aggregate, to be back to the starting line of pre-pandemic aggregates macroeconomically. So this is going to be a fairly long haul. But it does behove me to indicate that there is a massive degree of uncertainty out there. Now, it's sort of the way things are that we're looking at the downside uncertainties first off. So we're seeing inflation beginning to trouble policymakers. We're seeing global supply chains having difficulty getting started again. We're seeing a degree of tension in trade, in macroeconomic policy. So there are obvious downsides, and perhaps the overwhelming downside risk is that the pandemic persists, continues, new variants take the place of Omicron, and we can't get out of this mire as quickly as we would all wish to. But that's not inevitable. And of course, policy settings matter enormously in all of this. And I hope, and the UN is a classically important place for this to happen, I hope that we can find amongst policymakers internationally a greater appetite for cooperation, a greater feeling of common purpose to help things go along more quickly than perhaps some of us might be inclined to think they would on their current trajectories. You know, it is worrying, is it not, that, you know, we're getting in many respects further away from the objectives of the 2030 Sustainable Development Agenda, even as the clock ticks down towards 2030. More to do, less time to do it. Surely that should concentrate the minds of policymakers today.
Now, we weren't living in a golden age before the pandemic either. I mean, we had plenty of labour problems before then. You talk about a global labour market recovery, and your vision of that. Could you describe what that would look like in the ideal world?
Yeah, I think it's really important, as you've just said, not to look back to pre-March 2020 as some sort of golden age when we were all very happy and thought things were going along swimmingly. It wasn't at all like that, not at all like that. And so if we take seriously the notion of building back better, we take seriously the objectives of the 2030 agenda, our objective cannot be, should not be, simply getting back to the starting point of the pandemic, even if that might look to some of us as quite a benign past. We've got to do different things, and we're pointing the way forward. For example, in the global call to action that was adopted by the ILO conference in June of last year, global call to action for a human-centered recovery. Just to pick out some of the main parts of that, we really do need to take seriously, and my goodness, if the COVID-19 pandemic hasn't shown this to us, nothing will, seriously, the need to provide social protection to the majority of the world's population, which today has absolutely no social protection, and then are in a situation of extreme vulnerability when a shock hits, such as a global pandemic. So we need to move seriously towards universal social protection. Is it a utopia? No, it is not. It is affordable. It is doable. And then we have to navigate and promote the two transitions which I think stand foremost in most people's minds. We have to navigate towards carbon neutrality through a process of what we refer to as just transition. That is to say, a transition which also takes into account the economic and social concomitants of carbon neutrality, coming very sharply into focus in Glasgow last year, I would add. Digital transitions. Now, many of us believe, that the COVID experience has been an accelerator for digitalization processes already in motion, but we have to handle that well. And I'd add a third transition, if I might. It's a transition, again, made so important by COVID-19, towards a world where the care and the health economy, the care and the health sectors are invested in and accorded the importance, and the people who work in those sectors are given the right conditions to ensure that resilience, above all in respect of healthcare and caring, are given the priorities that they surely must be. A lot to do.
Yes, and finally, how confident are you? Do you think that we'll actually learn anything as an international community from this, or will we just be blundering from crisis to crisis?
Somebody said optimism is a duty, and I am dutifully optimistic. If we're not doing better in the future years, up to 2030 and beyond, I have to say we haven't got many excuses. We really do not have many excuses. I think the moral imperative of a more equal, a more solidaristic approach to managing the global economy, the self-preservation instinct of just transition to carbon neutrality. They're so obvious today. They are so obvious that inactivity or simply turning our eyes in a different direction brings with it, I think, a degree of culpability that will not be excused by the next generation or by history.